Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Commercial Real Estate Library podcast. This is episode 55. This is the show where we connect you with the brightest minds in the commercial real estate industry. Today is no different. We are joined by our special guest, John Nicola. He's the CEO and founder of Nicola Wealth. Nicola Wealth is a wealth management and commercial real estate company with $11.6 billion in assets under management. Originally founded in 1994, they have grown to become a behemoth in the commercial real estate space in addition to their wealth management business. In John's unique position as a wealth manager, we ask him his views on the global economy, rising interest rates, and how to make money in a rising interest rate climate, how to raise money for commercial real estate deals, how he got his start in the commercial real estate space, what does he think of the housing market in major cities across the country, and what's the best way to make money in commercial real estate today. You're gonna love this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to rate, comment, subscribe, share, all that good stuff. Enjoy. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Commercial Real Estate Library podcast. I'm Damon Tamanawala. You know my co-host, Garrett McGilvery. And joining us today is the CEO and the founder of Nicola Wealth, John Nicola. John, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, guys.
Awesome. Joining us from Maui.
Joining you from Maui. 5-hour time difference, but you know, you can get here in 10 hours if you want to get on a plane.
Perfect. See you tomorrow. So John, for the select group who maybe aren't as familiar with Nicola Wealth, can you share a little bit about who you are and what Nicola Wealth is?
Yeah, so we started in 1994, so I'd already been in the industry 20 years, so it's not like I started the business as part of my entry into financial services. And the job description you could give me was I was a financial advisor. So we did financial planning. We established insurance policies and programs for clients. We built retirement funds, typically using back then mutual funds. And that's still a large part of the traditional wealth services industry, even today, 27 years later. And about 6 years after that, we changed that. We morphed that into a different model, because if we wanted to work with high net worth clients, we realized that other firms like, you know, Burgundy Asset Management and PH&N at the time and Connor Clark and lots of really good examples were doing private counsel. So first off, they weren't commission-based, they were fee-based. They were providing direct access to their own pools. They were relatively cost-efficient. And they would, in some cases, offer alternative assets, and in particular, real estate, private mortgages, and then ultimately for us, private debt and private equity. So we evolved into a company that focused on financial planning, advanced financial planning for high net worth clients and ultra high net worth clients. So we could do some pretty sophisticated work at the planning level, but we wanted then to implement and manage the portfolio that we were handling for them with a kind of array of assets that you would see, let's say, in any of Canada's largest endowments or pension funds. And if you take a look at any of them, you'll see that they have a significant allocation to real estate, to private mortgages and debt and private equity and infrastructure. And there's a reason for that. It enhances returns and reduces volatility. And if you go to our website, you can see proof of that. We show all of our client returns for the last 22 years in comparison to all the major markets in the world over the same period of time and traditional 60-40 portfolios. And we've outperformed 60-40 portfolios over the last 22 years by an average of 2.5% per year, which is a lot.
That'll add up. Years.
And yet we've had less volatility than the 60-40 portfolio would have had. So that's what we do, and that's really where our space is. That so we're I should also mention we're probably about now we started basically with public assets only. We did our first real estate project in 2000, I should say, and really small, really small, Now we're probably 50% private assets. Of the assets we manage, 50% are private and 50% are public.
Wow. That's very interesting. So okay, so this is a real estate podcast. So we're gonna navigate over to real estate soon. But I'd love to know, John, about kind of the early stages of the founding of the company. Because even, you know, you mentioned you'd been in the industry for a while even before then. But can you talk about the first year and getting, like, what does that look like in terms of wealth management, and how are you convincing people to kind of jump in with you?
Yeah, it's an interesting comment. Because I've been in the industry 20 years, and the previous 10 years, I was a principal. In fact, I was a president and equal shareholder with Jim Rogers of the Rogers Group. So I was already in an independent financial planning firm. And only because of, let's say, a difference of view and opinion between Jim and myself, did I find myself deciding to start my own enterprise. But essentially, I started it with, let's say, $80 million of client money under management and maybe 150 households as clients already. So I wasn't starting from zero. So we were profitable from the beginning because we had an infrastructure already in place that was now moved to a different model and brand. The real epiphany and where the other assets came in, like, for example, coming back to the real estate you mentioned earlier, that didn't come in until a friend of mine who was in the property management business, a fellow named Dave Crosby, and he owned a really big property management firm in Vancouver. We're good friends. And he just said to me, and you never think about these things until somebody suggests it. He said, John, I don't really understand it, but I've got a lot of wealthy clients that I manage assets for. And you have a lot of wealthy clients that you manage assets for. But basically, at the end of the day, neither one of us, neither Dave nor I, had any interest in any commercial real estate. And he said, so why is that? You know, and I said, well, I have no idea why that is. You know, what do you think? And then we decided that we should take a look and say, why not do this? And if we were going to do it for ourselves, why wouldn't we do it for clients? And so we emerged into our first project in 2000. And I will tell you, you know, as I look at it in hindsight, it seemed great at the time. But in hindsight, I mean, it earned a decent enough return eventually, but it was fine. But it was, you know, a pretty cheap and cheerful, you know, strip mall, you know, in the outskirts of Victoria, $3.2 million total price. $8 million total price, $3.2 million of equity. And so 32 people, our clients, put in $100,000 each. We created a limited partnership. They owned it. We had this other firm do the property management for it, and we kept it for 5 or 6 years. I think basically everybody probably walked away with about a 10 to 12% return, and it worked fine. And then Dave and I said, okay, well, I guess that worked out okay. Should we do this again? And we did it 5 more times. And finally, in 2005, I said, you know what? The problem with this model is that it's all closed end. I invest in one property. I'm not getting diversification here. Some clients get to come in, some clients don't because it's oversubscribed. I said, so it doesn't really work for my business. So I said, why don't we ask the clients how they feel if all the existing assets, we take all of them and roll them into a single pool, and everybody has an undivided interest in all the properties. And then we allow that pool to continue. New money can come in. We'll figure out a way that we're going to deploy it, and we'll add more properties to it. And that's how we created our first real estate fund in 2005, which is also on our website. All the details about the fund and its returns and everything else, they're all on our website. And we've had that fund now. It was 17 years old. And that fund started maybe with a portfolio of, I'm going to say, at the time, $60, $70 million. And then that is now almost $2 billion. And so essentially the concept was to say to people, if you start with us as a client today, and we want you in real estate, we don't want you making your first investment in a project. Because the minute you do that, number one, you give up liquidity because you can't get it back until a project is done or finished or the building is sold. And number two, you still have no diversification. You have one investment in one building. That's it. If you come into a pool like we have, which is really a private REIT, you have 150 assets spread out all throughout North America. So you are instantly diversified. And because it's large enough, we can provide liquidity to anybody within 6 months without any transaction costs. So therefore, it gave us a massive competitive advantage over, as you can appreciate. So we measure the returns against our private REIT. We have a US one, a Canadian one, and a development one. Let's say our benchmarks would be, you know, the TSX REIT index, the NAREIT index in the US, like that, right? So we've outperformed both of those REIT indices, net of fees, with 20% of the volatility of those pools. And I remember one criticism I got, actually, I got this from one of our inside guys that deals in public equities. He said, John, the problem, you're being artificial. The fact is, private REITs are not actually marked to market. They're not trading at market values. And I said, I hate to tell you this, his name is Rob. I said, I hate to tell you this, Rob, but actually the opposite, the exact opposite of your statement is what is really true. I said, if you want proof of that, go to your own analysts and ask the major bank analysts to give them long-term breakdown details of all the REITs in North America and when they trade above NAV and when they trade below NAV. So the REIT prices have nothing to do with the market for real estate. That's why you get appraisals and find out how assets buy and sell. So sometimes, most of the time, REITs trade above NAV, so they're expensive ways to buy real estate. Sometimes, like in COVID or in 2008, they trade well below NAV, in which case the cheapest place to buy real estate is in the stock market. But the point is that our private REIT is the actual market value of the real estate, and the REITs are not. The REITs simply are subject to the emotional ability of people to buy and sell them rapidly and quickly and get panicky. They have no relationship to what's actually going in terms of the marketplace, in terms of the buying and selling of real estate. So it's an interesting thing because most people would assume that the REITs are the real market and everybody else is creating artificial pricing. And it's just completely the other way around.
Gary, let me know if you want to jump in here. I got 100 questions too.
Yeah, I was actually going to jump a little more into the real estate side of things.
Sure.
So you started the fund in 2005.
Yeah. The first investment was 2000, but the first fund was 2005, sure. And that was just a Canadian fund.
Yeah.
And then we started to buy U.S. assets as well. You know, slowly. And by 2009, we said we have actually quite a few U.S. assets. And because we knew clients wanted to have assets denominated in U.S. dollars, we said, well, it doesn't make sense to leave them in the same fund. So we split them. Mm-hmm. So now all the U.S. assets are in U.S. dollars and in a U.S. fund. And all the Canadian assets are in the Canadian fund and they're separated. But most clients own and share units in both pools.
Okay. And then what, I know that you guys provide other securities as well, like in terms of like private debt.
So private debt is relatively newer. It's about 5 or 6 years old. And from our perspective, our first private debt was actually commercial mortgages because they are actually still private. They're not publicly traded, right?
Yeah.
And we created our own mortgage pools way early back in the 2004, 2003. And we now manage two different mortgage pools in Canadian mortgages only for about $800 million of assets. And that's a very low volatile. It's kind of like a GIC alternative. It's got great liquidity on a monthly basis, extremely low volatility. I think over the last, I'm going to say it's not quite 20 years, but it's close to 20 years. The largest negative return on both of the mortgage pools in any single month was minus 1.2%. There has never been a year that we've had where they've ever had a negative return. And so the volatility is very low. So basically, it's a great place because the returns for the last 20 years have been in the 4 to 5.5% range, which in today's interest environment is excellent. And so that's a nice safe place for, and that is private debt. And then subsequently, we realized that we also manage high yield bonds for clients as well, in public companies, stuff like that. And we got to realize that we might have, again, less volatility and a better net yield if we started to work with groups and like Crown Financial that operated in private debt. So we started that private debt model, let's say 7 years ago, and now we have, it's about us, approximately about a $450 million pool of private debt. And last year did really well. It came in around 12% net income, but over the last 5 years, it's averaged around 9%. We would like to think that we can probably get between a 7 to 9% net return. Mm-hmm. And in our case, now the negative of it, coming back to financial planning for a second, is that it's virtually all interest income. So naturally, of course, tax at the highest rate. So we will use these private debt mortgage pools and stuff like that. We'll put them in clients' individual pension plans. We'll put them in their RSPs. We'll put them in their TFSAs. We'll put them in their foundations. And so they don't pay any tax on the interest. But then they're still balanced, right? So we de-risk the entire portfolio, but we don't want to pay tax on the part of it that generates the highest amount of taxable income.
So, Mark, with that being said, obviously, Nicola Wealth being in pretty much a large number of aspects of real estate, bringing it to sort of more of the present times, with obviously inflation being high, the worry of interest rates going up, what are your thoughts on the current commercial real estate marketplace in Canada?
Well, I mean, I think it's a little bit in dangerous territory. I mean, I think at the end of the day, people that have been in commercial real estate in Canada, well, quite frankly, around the world, but certainly in North America, but absolutely in Canada, have had the wind at their back for the last 10 to 12 years. They've been basically in a flat to declining interest rate environment. There's been no recession. And there's been, issues in terms of, land availability, product availability, good population growth. I mean, pretty well everything you can imagine working on behalf of elevating real estate prices generally and lowering cap rates. So just imagine you come to this turning point, which I would seriously argue we're at, and realize that, interest rates will have to rise. They've already risen in Canada. 10-year bond rates have risen more than 100 basis points in the last 12 months alone. So is that going to stop? Not likely. So in my view, the low-hanging fruit basically is gone. And what you're dealing with now is if you can't figure out a way to add value to what you're doing, then essentially your rate of return if you think of the market giving you a beta return, is going to be, I think, noticeably lower. It won't be zero, but will be noticeably lower in the next decade as opposed to the last decade. So basically, you didn't have to be really talented to make a decent return in real estate for the last decade, but you're really going to have to work it to get the results in the next decade. So to create alpha, we have to add value. So in our case, we've gone from 0% build to own in our income pools to about 30% build to own, because the value you get at the front end and the final asset you get before you start to move it into the income stream, it's a brand new asset. You don't need CapEx. It's got better technology. It's more environmentally suitable and so on and so forth. And you say, that means then I have a better portfolio of assets. And I picked up the lift from the development phase in creating the asset in the first place. I'm willing to take that risk because that's where I'm going to have to add value to get the return. And so whether it's leasing or whether it's looking at a covered property at play where it basically it's underdeveloped land and you can add to whatever you've got there in terms of building space, you have to look at every aspect of this to decide how you're going to do better. It's going to be harder, in my opinion, to get the returns going forward in real estate, not just real estate, all asset classes, but absolutely in real estate.
You heard it here first. Get out while you can. I'm just kidding. So value add strategies, kind of development is an area of focus. Do you have any maybe primary versus secondary markets? Do you have an opinion on, like, is it better to be in Vancouver versus Victoria, or Hamilton versus Toronto? anything like any?
I think, I mean, certainly for us, this is what, these are the decisions we've made, is we are in the Golden Horseshoe and committed to that area and have a pretty large amount of our portfolio there. We have a significant part of the portfolio in BC, and that would include the Lower Mainland, the Okanagan, and Vancouver Island, Victoria area, and in Nanaimo as well. Really, what we tend to look for are things that are driving outcomes, which clearly you start with demographics, and then you start with population growth and economic growth. So you're starting there, that helps you. Speaking of value add, you reduce your risk by taking that on. The interesting thing now would be that, of course, you're well aware of how relatively depressed the Alberta market is in Calgary. And I have a feeling that that even though there's still not insignificant risk there, that risk is going to be mitigated. And so therefore, a return to Alberta to take a look at maybe some of the value propositions that exist there, as long as you get a long time horizon, I think basically that may turn out to be a really good decision. So those would be the areas that we would focus on from a Canadian perspective. And then we have a different model geographically and demographically in the US.
Interesting. And what, I don't want to make you say something super dramatic here, but what asset classes are you most wary of? And, you know, where should investors, you know, think to kind of lower their allocation in the next 5 years if they have like a 5-year outlook? Sorry.
Okay, so I think it's safe to say, I mean, a lot of the areas that are challenged, like retail and office, that's already started to be reflected in the pricing and the cap rates for those assets already. So again, coming back to the specifics, you know, so the devil's in the details. So let's say, for instance, not far from where I live in Vancouver, there's a, I don't want to call it a tacky shopping mall, but let's face it, it needs a serious facelift. But where is it located? It's located at 25th and Oak, which for those people who understand Vancouver is one of the most expensive neighborhoods in the entire city. And it's really underdeveloped and it's right next to the hospital. So do I think there's a covered land play with respect to that kind of retail that could be blended into residential and all the rest of that? So it's all about the details. Like, it's about the facts of the situation in front of you. And so you can't really just say, forget retail. It's how you look at retail. And you can't really say, forget office. Same issues, right, that you look at. So I think we have not said no to all retail and no to all commercial, but without question, our bigger focus has been in multifamily residential and in industrial and in specialty. Like, we have a reasonably decent size portfolio of mini storage facilities, both in Canada and in the US. And we like that because it's a simple play. It tends to have a low CapEx requirements. And the reality of people, if you're in the right locations for population growth and people are having relatively smaller homes or apartments, of course, the demand for storage goes up because, we're all junkies when it comes to collecting things. We never seem to get rid of them, right? So we just store them.
So, so John, so you guys at Nicola on the real estate side have completed a lot of transactions this year. I feel like you guys have, incrementally become one of the, or maybe exponentially become one of the more dominant groups in commercial real estate. How have you guys been able to break into these markets and be so successful transacting? Because I think I read a RENX article that you guys completed 2 billion in acquisitions.
About 2 billion. I think, I mean, part of it is that. So our real estate group, so this may sound strange to people that are in the asset management business, I don't want it to sound as if it's hubris, but it's our asset managers. So we're talking now the real estate group, the private debt mortgage groups, the public asset groups, stuff like that, have never had to worry where their money was coming from for investment purposes, ever. So our business works this way. We attract clients who come and see the advisory teams, get the estate and financial planning done, get the net worth calculations done, get the recommendations for a portfolio. And then they say, okay, well, you know, we like what you're doing. We're going to give you a portfolio of take over our $5 million existing portfolio. And they already know basically that we want to put 32% of it into real estate. And they know that we want, you know, 14% of that Canadian and maybe 16% US and so on and so forth like that. So in other words, we send this money to the real estate group. They don't have to go. They don't have to solicit clients. They don't have to basically put on. They do presentations because our clients like to see what's going on. But essentially, they're not out there in the fundraising capacity, which is a huge win because now they can spend their time developing and looking from an analytical perspective at the kinds of assets on the marketplace and stuff like that. And of course, we have an incredibly high closing rate. So the brokers in the industry know that. Essentially, and they can bring us a transaction and say, okay, if we make an offer, the chances of us walking away from that offer are really close to zero. So that makes a difference, obviously, to people wanting to bring us potential transactions. And then finally, we do have partners. For instance, in the US, we have our partner in the US is actually a Toronto-based firm that specializes in refurbishing multifamily residential units, typically in the American Southeast and Texas, in areas like that. And they probably now, I think they've got something like 20,000 units. We have an undivided interest in 14,000 units spread over 75 buildings across 10 different states. But they are the operating partner and they've been a great partner. We've been working with them for 15 years. We have
developed— Who's that, by the way, John?
It's Vantara Realty in Toronto.
Okay.
And a great firm, by the way, a fantastic group of people. And then we have developers both in Toronto and in BC that we work with for our value add fund and our income fund. So in other words, in some cases, we're doing a transaction with, let's say, maybe just to build condos. It could be something else. It could be an industrial strata. And they're the developer. So typically we will put up 80% of the capital. We co-underwrite with them, you know, the project, but they are going to be the GP. They're going to be the developer and they have to put up 20% typically of the capital. And then they get a carried interest on a performance basis. And that project is then put into our value add fund, which is done really well. So, but sometimes we do build to own, in which case, if we do build to own, often the developer, to be fair, can't afford to leave that money on the table. So we make a deal that when the project is finished, we will then go to the developer and say, okay, let's just get it appraised and we're going to buy you out at that appraisal. So we got 80% at cost and then 20% at market when the project is finished. And so we're happy with that, to do that as well. So that's typically how we choose who to work with. And that's why we've got a lot of people, including developers, that have come to us and said, okay, well, you know, we'd like to talk to you about a strategy. And I've said with Mark, to anybody that we work with, I said, look, we have no interest in doing a one-off deal. So if you can't convince us that there's a pipeline here that we could rely on over time of 4 or 5 or 6 projects, we don't really want to get started. You know, it's just too much work to trying to figure out how the relationships work and do the due diligence and all the other things that we need to do.
And this is with all real estate assets. Like I owe Mark a call, but
no, it's not Damon. So this is only development real estate, and we're now doing our own development projects. Like for instance, we're building a building we hope is a mass timber building at Cambie and 7th in Vancouver. This is the old Robinson Lighting building. So we bought the building. And we're in the process of trying to get permits and design to build a 10 to 12 story mass timber building. Now, we're actually, our own firm will occupy most of this building. But that is a development project that's inside. It's built to own. We're the tenant. We obviously have to pay market rents and we're fine with that. And at the end of it, that is something that is essentially collectively owned between our firm and our clients. That's an example of development. So we are doing... we've got a major residential apartment project at Main and 7th in Vancouver as well. And so we have got maybe 5 or 6 projects which are internally designed and created. And our income funds, almost all of the assets except for Ventura's assets in the US are 100% owned by us and are sourced by us. In other words, so our team is doing the analysis work. They're reviewing with brokers the opportunities. They're going to market. Sometimes we do get private and off-market transactions as well. But we're, Mark's team has the ability to do all of that analysis, and we always assume on the both income funds, we're buying 100% of the asset. We don't generally go looking for partners at all.
Just a quick question. So when you do have properties set in the income fund, obviously you guys are termed out for mortgages. Do you refinance at the end of terms to pull out money to distribute to investors, or do you just simply continue paying down capital?
So interesting, because it's a pool, and this is an interesting question here. So part of Mark's team, so Mark actually has a three-person finance team, and their job isn't to do the internal financial finance requirements like a controller. Their job is to take a look at every single asset we have constantly and decide on the maturities that we are going to do and the mortgages and the relationships we're going to have. And are we going to make the interest rate floating? Like, here's an interesting example mathematically about return that most people don't think about. So let's say I've got a portfolio of three buildings worth $100 million and they've got $50 million of debt. Okay, let's assume the debt has been recently refinanced, and so the mortgages are 3.5%. Okay, and that might be a bit high, but let's say it's 3.5%. Okay, you're amortizing the mortgage. So basically, when you take a look at your mortgage payment, most of the mortgage payment is actually principal at that interest rate. Mm-hmm. Now, the highest return that those payments can get is 3.5%. It's impossible. So if you're in a fund that's earning a 10% return over a decade, amortizing your mortgages is destructive to your total return. It has to be financially, mathematically. Now, let's imagine that you were able to convince the bank, and we have done this, that what we want to do, even if it was a lower loan to value, we want interest only as if it was a long-term floating line of credit. In which case, of course, you're paying 3%, but it's interest only, so naturally your payments are lower. You're not amortizing it. It's not in your interest to amortize it. Do you follow?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right. So if we refinance traditional mortgages, we will do that every 5 years if it makes sense. But it doesn't go back to our clients in the way you're thinking, because our clients are in a pool. So really, it all happens is the money comes into the pool and we presumably buy more assets, which means the client now has an undivided interest in more assets without actually putting more money into the pool. And right now, I mean, we distribute 5.5% income monthly, you know, roughly a little under half of 1% a month. 80% of our clients, so we do this for all clients, right? 80% of our clients use a drip to put it back in automatically. So they don't actually require the income. So when we take a look at new capital, you can imagine that new capital comes in from refinancing. It comes in from selling assets occasionally. We don't sell that often. It comes in from the drip, and it comes in from new capital coming into the company. So Mark and his team can have a decent idea ahead of time. I can tell them right now at the beginning of this year, you should expect this much new capital from all sources in the next 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
And give or take a bit, you know, if we really do super well like we did last year, that can get accelerated. And sometimes we have a wait list. Like, we've had a wait list on our development pool for 18 months. So if you wanted to get in, you had to stand on the sidelines for typically a person getting into the wait list would have to wait 9-12 months to get in. Wow. Because we didn't want to dilute returns, obviously, for the people that were already in there.
Yeah, you're not just going to start buying assets because you have the money.
Yeah, right.
Gotcha. Okay, so earlier on this chat, you mentioned a couple tax strategies, and I know tax strategy is a big part of Nicola Wealth. But maybe I'm thinking, I work in the apartment space, right? And a lot of my clients are maybe second or third generation families of the original builders and have immense capital gains to pay upon a disposition. Maybe more if Trudeau decides it.
Maybe, yeah.
So So like, what are some of the better strategies that you've seen employed by private guys on a disposition in order to kind of lower their tax burden?
Well, okay, so obviously the lower the turnover on the real estate, the lower the tax liability is going to be. Yeah. And that's ignoring other transaction costs like, commissions, trading costs, property purchase tax, and stuff like that. So the way I look at it is, on a typical asset, your turnover costs from buying and selling could be as high as 30 to 35% of your gain. So we're talking a lot of money, okay, a very significant amount of money. So the question you have to ask yourself is, okay, let's say I've got an older asset, like an older apartment building, 60 years old, and let's face it, if you keep doing CapEx and stuff like that, you can sell it for a good price, but you have to ask yourself, well, maybe what I should do is demolish it. Okay, first off, if I demolish it, I completely cancel any recapture of depreciation on the building. It's gone, okay, right? And then I start a brand new building. Okay, it's going to cost me money. I'm going to have to finance it. I don't want to have cash flow for, 3 years or 4 years. But the bottom line is that I will end up with a brand new building with brand new levels of depreciation. There's been no capital gains tax in this entire transaction. And I could probably finance the actual development and building of this if it's multifamily residential with CMHC at incredibly good rates. So, yeah, I would look at that and say, okay, well, that would be the strategy. You know, unless I absolutely said I've got to get out of real estate and I never want to see it again. Right, because there's not much point in me selling that asset because somebody is willing to give me a big price and then go buy another one.
Right.
Mm. Okay. That seems like, so that's one way. Another way for a lot of our clients who are very wealthy and have been with real estate is to say, okay, well, what is your estate plan? Like, is all your money going to your kids or your grandkids? And generally the answer is no. And they talk about various organizations they want to support and things like that. And I say, okay, well, look, here's how the math works. If you created your own foundation or donor advised fund, basically you could complete a transaction. So let's take it to the extreme. Okay. Let's imagine I got a building worth $50 million. Let's say the cost base is only $10 million. I got a $40 million gain. Okay. And I'm going to ignore the limitations on charitable giving rules and stuff like that, just to keep it simple. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to sell a building for $50 million. I'm going to give $20 million to my own foundation, which I had intended to give through my estate anyway, but I'm going to do it now. Mm. I'm not going to pay any tax then on that transaction. I got $30 million tax paid dollars. I go buy another asset. In theory, my foundation could buy an asset as well, right? So I still have $50 million to play with. It's just not in that building anymore. And $20 million of it is in a tax-free environment. And assuming I'm giving away 5% of the $20 million each year, that's $1 million a year I'm giving away to charities I want to support anyway. So when you start actually to do the math, the fact is you can take that, in theory, huge problem, okay, and which would have been, in this case, $10 or $11 million in tax, and say, well, I can make that zero.
Wow. And assuming that people are all good, they'll use the funds and, give it to a charity, a worthwhile cause, something like that. Is there a way to do that if the charity is the charity of yourself? Do you know what I mean?
Such thing. You do need a legitimate charitable number. The CRA is actually very diligent with foundations and donor advised funds. And so none of this stuff works unless it's your intention, it's like, but if you think about it logically, if some person has a $50 million building, it wouldn't be a stretch to imagine they're worth at least $100 million. Yeah. And basically, if I said, okay, fine, you die tomorrow, you're $100 million. And if you die tomorrow, you're absolutely paying the $10 million of tax on that building, even if you don't sell it. Okay. So you've already got the liability. So they say, okay, well, John, how much would I have to give away upon my death and my estate? And I say, well, let's say $30 million. So you could give $30 million away to your foundation or donor advised fund, and $70 million would be tax paid. And then I say to the client, so why would you wait until you die for that to happen? Okay. Mm-hmm. What would the point be? Because you can't seriously tell me that you can't afford to live on $70 million. Obviously, that's not the case. Okay. So if you can basically eliminate all the tax in your estate without having to die, wouldn't that be the better plan?
But if you died in advance of that, could you still allocate it to the fund and do the same strategy? Yeah, you could. Yeah.
Okay. As long as it's done within a year of the date of death, you can still accomplish the same thing. But you have to lay very specific instructions in your will, because if you don't, it basically, there's no reason to think that's actually going to happen.
Hey, I got another one. So, you've been in this business for so long, it's tough to kind of break it down to the basics, but like, do you have any advice for people trying to raise capital? I mean, you're essentially a steward of people's capital, and you allow it to grow and monitor it and everything like that. But if you're at the beginning stage, if you're trying to go out and, start a $20 million development project, as maybe Garrett and I are trying to do.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for raising capital and getting investors on board?
Well, okay. So it's an interesting question. I can only think in terms of the developer partners we already have. So presumably they had the same issue. And my guess is that they started with the classical friends and family approach. And that part is okay. It has some obvious limitations, not the least of which, ultimately in the long run, can be compliance. Because in theory, you're basically offering an investment product without being licensed as advisors to be allowed to sell an investment product. And quite frankly, do I think the OSE or the BCSC would look at this askance and say, wait a minute, what qualifications do you have? And what offering memorandum are you providing? What disclosures are you doing? And where's the conflict of interest issues? And how much do you want to get into that? Because what if the friends and families gets into some strangers? In other words, your friends say, well, I've got a friend of a friend of a friend, and they wouldn't mind investing. And so what happens is, effectively, for all intents and purposes, you start off with this friends and family model, and basically in no time you're running a fund, but you're not licensed to run a fund. Okay, so there is that concern. So my view would have been, and this is what our developer partners are doing, at least with us, is they're saying, okay, we're their partner. That's one entity. We are already licensed. And we, like an institution, can write the check. So basically, then you say to yourself, okay, so what larger groups would I approach about this? And quite frankly, you could approach wealth management firms and say, okay, you, the wealth management firm, will be vetting it for your clients. And as far as we're concerned, we're just getting one check from you. And you're figuring out how to apportion it amongst all of your clients that are participating in it. So I probably, if I were you, I would approach wealth management firms. I would approach other kinds of financial advisors, some of them large enough to have a large portfolio of clients, which could effectively do the same thing. For really big investors, you can talk to firms like ours. You can talk to pensions institutions. They can all make this decision because, again, it's the one check rule. They've got the ability, they've got the authority to go ahead and make that decision about whether or not this is a prudent or reasonable investment. So that's where I'd suggest you go. I think that the idea that you're going to find yourself with 50 or 100 investors all writing their checks into your developments is probably not the best way to go.
Okay, interesting. I picture there's a lot of liquidity around in real estate these days. I picture myself taking a hat and walking around my office to all the happy industrial brokers.
Yeah, right. And in fact, you can absolutely do that. I just say that in terms of you developing a sustainable model. So assuming, if you think about this, you don't build a business with the idea that you can just do it once and, that was nice. What should we do tomorrow? You actually build it with the idea that you're going to build on it. So if the first project is successful, why wouldn't you do the second and the third and the fourth? And now you start to multiply what you just said, Damon, ask yourself, what does this look like in 5 years? And then all of a sudden you say, wow, I'm spending my entire life having to deal with reporting to investors, figuring out who's going to come in on the new thing, doing the dog and pony show about raising money. And what I'm not doing is actually developing. Okay, so which diminishes the outcomes and the returns for the actual investors. So the paradox is it's not in the investor's interest for you to be out there with your hat raising money.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask, as a wealth manager, now everybody and their parents are an armchair expert now in the stock market, in the real estate market.
Yeah.
You see the kind of craziness that's going on. I was looking at a house just the other day and I missed out because a preemptive offer came in. And before you know it, 15 preemptive offers were registered and it ended up selling $1 million over asking. So this is the world that we live in right now. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's a bit nutty. It is crazy. On housing, it is pretty stupid.
What do you have any kind of general advice for people just thinking about how to manage their investments for, you know, the next year or the next couple of years?
Well, okay, so I don't think of housing as an investment. I mean, generally, and it's interesting, we had this debate. So my son, and maybe this comparison is a really good comparison. My son and daughter-in-law are buying, they want to move to a bigger house. So they found a lot. It's pretty expensive in Vancouver. And then it's rented. There's a house in it, they're rented, but they're going to have to tear it down and rebuild. Okay. Mm. And so in the meantime, they can't really hold onto their house and they can't hold onto two houses at one time. So interestingly, so let's say their house is the one that they're selling is worth $3 million. Okay. So they say to us or to me specifically, well, why don't you guys buy the house? Because then you could just rent it back to us and then that would all work out really well. And I said, okay, I want you to think about what you just said. Okay. So let's say I've got $3 million already in our real estate pools and it's generating for me right now 5.5% income, which is $165,000 a year. And it has a long-term rate of return of, let's say, 10% a year. Okay. And it's relatively liquid. I can liquidate it in 6 months. Okay. So let's say that's my default. Mm-hmm. And then let's say I buy this house for $3 million. The first thing I'm going to have to do is pay $90,000 in property purchase tax. I'm also going to have to start paying the school tax in BC because it hits in at $3 million. Finally, even if you're willing to pay rent of $7,500 a month, which is above market, by the time I pay all the expenses, I'm going to be lucky to net $4,000 a month, which is $50,000 a year, give or take. And that is one third of the income I'm already making. In fact, at $50,000 a year, you have to rent it for 2.5 years or 2 years plus just for me to recover the property purchase tax. Mm-hmm. So I said, now, my job is to be a financial advisor and to take a look and say, there's nothing wrong with investing in real estate. Let's just take a look at what the choices look like and decide from an investment perspective. So if you want to buy a house because you got to live somewhere, you need to be in a location, you want to go have your kids at certain schools or whatever, fine. It's a personal decision. And then now you're trying to manage the least expensive way to buy the personal decision. Okay. But as long as that's your framework, at least that's what it should be. So we have never invested in residential housing and we never will.
Okay. I love the thought of your kids coming to you and saying, well, you know, what about this? And 5 minutes later, you've got your math and a spreadsheet and they're walking away and you're like, no, come here. No, I want to explain this.
Yeah. So bottom line is they will end up selling and they will end up renting, but they won't be renting from us.
we actually have an upcoming podcast. This is one of my last questions. We've got an upcoming podcast with an individual who's buying tons of residential real estate at scale.
And they've probably done really well so far, haven't they?
I think it's at its infancy though. So they're doing it in Canada versus, you know, a lot of success stories in the US. Would you think that that's a bad strategy or?
Well, generally speaking,